A chill wind blows on a black night. The place, Washington, D.C., the capital of a divided nation. It has been a rain-filled April. Pennsylvania Avenue is awash with mud and muck. The city sleeps, but it's a mournful sleep. One of those who mourns is the wife of the President of the United States. Abraham Lincoln has been assassinated. This week, we observe the 100th anniversary of the death of Abraham Lincoln. So let us go back 100 years ago and relive those days. Let us meet the people who walked in the shadow of Lincoln, some who loved him, some who hated him. Tonight, 100 years ago, President Lincoln had just 2 days left to live. The conspirators had made their plans. They only waited for the right moment to strike. These are the last days of Lincoln.
The Last Days of Lincoln. This series is brought to you by Twin City Federal, headquarters for savings accounts, home loans, and home improvement loans, and by the Lincoln National Life Insurance Company of Fort Wayne, Indiana, and your Lincoln Life general agents in the Twin Cities, Lynn M. Elling and Associates of Minneapolis, James J. Sheehan and Associates, St. Paul. Now, 100 years ago tonight, the last days of Lincoln.
Bright sunshine lightened the capital of Washington, D.C. on this day a century ago. City gardeners worked among the tulip beds along the mall, and robins chattered a tune of spring in the elms. It was April 13th, a cheery day, made even more so by the knowledge that the great Civil War was becoming a matter for the history books, and the populace could turn to other things. The Union hero, General Ulysses S. Grant, was in Washington, along with his wife. A state ball had been planned for the occasion, and the wife of the president was planning a theater party for tomorrow night, Good Friday, at Ford's Theater. Capital gossips were saying that the Lincolns had planned a theater party instead of an expensive state reception because of recent criticism of White House expenses. But regardless, somehow, somewhere, there would have to be a public appearance of the president and the man who won the war, General Grant. For President Lincoln, this day would be uneventful, but it would not be so for his assassin-to-be, John Wilkes Booth. For the dark, wavy-haired actor, this would be another day to sow another snare into the net. Booth could not fail again. He was sulky and sullen now, having made bungling failures of earlier attempts upon the life of Lincoln. But even Booth, on this day, April 13th, did not know that he would pull the trigger on the night of the following day. Let us examine the recent events which endangered President Lincoln's life. John Wilkes Booth played what would prove to be his last professional role last Saturday night. He was Pescara in The Apostate at Ford's Theater. It was that night when he learned President Lincoln would be at the old soldier's home the following Monday to attend a matinee of the play Still Water Runs Deep. The title must have struck Booth's fancy because he decided that Lincoln must be kidnapped that Monday. At this point, Booth was thinking in terms of just abducting the president. The scene, along a tree-shaded lane leading to the old soldier's home in Washington. A carriage pulled by a matched team of horses approaches. Waiting for the carriage is Booth and his men. Their plan, to kidnap the president, who is inside the carriage.
Here it comes, men. That must be the president's carriage. Sam, you and I will head it off and take care of the driver. Payne, you and Harold grab the passenger. Cop the pistols, men!
But, John, that's not the president in that carriage. See for yourself.
Let's get out of here.
Hey, what are you men up to?
We've been fooled.
And so, one attempt against Lincoln ended in miserable failure. It had turned out that the president had called off his visit to the soldiers' home to present a flag to a group of returning Union soldiers. But some historians say that Booth was so upset over this failure that he soon resolved to drop the kidnap plan in favor of outright assassination. There was another time that Booth made an attempt on Lincoln's life and failed again. It was in March. Booth was taking Lewis Payne, the ex-Confederate soldier, who later would hang, on a tour of the White House grounds. They fell into conversation.
You know, Lewis, a man who really wanted to slay the tyrant could do it easily. He could simply go to the front entrance of the White House, present a calling card, Lincoln always sees petitioners. Why, you could walk right into his office and shoot him on the spot.
Well, maybe he could at that, but I don't know.
What's the matter, Lewis? Not losing your nerve, are you?
No, it's not that. There's just something wrong with the idea, that's all.
Well, there are other ways, too. Look at those bushes right by the path. You know, a man could lie in the shrubs at dusk and pick off the president when he came back from the War Department. He makes that walk every night, you know. If you had the nerve, you could waylay him right there.
Lewis Payne, big and brutish, but a soldier's soldier, saw more sense in making the attack upon the president from the solitude of a piece of shrubbery. He agreed. An outdoor ambush was more to his liking. That night, as gas lamps dimmed around the capital city, Payne took to his solitary hiding place amid the bushes outside the front door of the White House. A light rain had frozen on the ground. It was damp and chilly at this time of night, but Payne waited patiently, as his master, John Wilkes, had dictated. Soon, footsteps echoed from the sidewalk. Lincoln approached, accompanied by a heavy-set man.
Major, spread out, or we shall soon break through the ice.
Lincoln's words, spoken as a joke, threw Payne off base. Spread out, which he took as a warning and not a jest, made his fingers freeze on the trigger. Lincoln and his companion walked past, and Payne lost his chance to gun the president down. Payne, pictured by historians as a brainless vassal to Booth, had bungled the job. And this made Booth even more determined that there should be no mistakes the next time. But there was a next time, and there were more mistakes. This time, Booth read in the Washington Star that the president would attend a performance of the Italian opera Il Nanni. The state box had been reserved, and hastily, John Wilkes laid his plans again. Booth's misery in not being able to carry out the job increased even more at this point. Two of his conspirators, Mike McLaughlin and Sam Arnold, bowed out of the whole thing, and the president never showed up at the theater. Booth's bitterness increased to the boiling point when he received a letter from Arnold.
Please consider deferring the undertaking for a time. Do not act rashly or in haste. Weigh all I have said as a rational man and a friend. You cannot censure or upbraid my conduct.
Booth, angry and red-eyed, tossed the letter into his steamer trunk in his hotel room. Authorities would later find it, and Sam Arnold would later regret having written it. But Booth's group of conspirators was getting smaller now with each passing day. There was Payne, of course, and although a good follower and strong of arm, Booth thought of him as a machine-like clod. There was Davy Harold, faithful and loyal to Booth's persuasions, who knew the country like the back of his hand. And there was the drunk, George Atzerodt. But Booth's tiny circle of compatriots was getting smaller and smaller. President Lincoln's time upon this earth amounted to less than 48 hours now, and as the frustrated Booth sought a new scheme, the official city of Washington went on its merry way. There were victory parties to attend and people to see. Hoop-skirted young ladies sat back in leisure as their carriages wound their way through the muddy streets.
Margaret, I do believe I've never seen the Capitol so pretty.
Nor the men in such abundance. Look at that group of Yankees there. A handsome lot, I must say.
Children played in the yards in the outlying areas as their parents laid plans to attend celebrations. After all, things were looking up, not down for a change, and one must enjoy himself while one can. The offices in the Washington business area clanged and bustled, and the workers did their jobs at double time, hoping to get home early and continue the celebrations. That was 100 years ago on this very day. And for Lincoln, it is far too late to turn back the hands of time. And for John Wilkes Booth, it is far too late to prevent him from stitching the last portion of his death-dealing web. 100 years ago this day was a day of gloom for the actor. At least it began that way. But it did not end that way. What made the big difference, what made Booth's emotions soar from frustration to joy, was a small bit of news he had picked up. He had drifted into Grover's Theater, sure that he may never get another chance at Lincoln, when he heard news that galvanized him into deadly action.
Booth, I say, have you heard the news?
No, I've not heard any news. And I might say I don't wish to.
Well, don't be so in the dumps. After all, the president is going to the theater tomorrow night. Haven't you heard?
What is that? To the theater? Here at Grover's?
No, John. He's going with the Grants to Ford's Theater.
That doesn't make sense. Ford is playing the American cousin with Laura Keene. Lincoln's tastes don't run that way.
I tell you, it's true. And why shouldn't it be? General Grant is in town. And Lincoln and his lady plan to take Grant to Ford's for a theater party.
Oh, I see.
Booth may have had a hard time keeping his joy from rising to the surface. At last, here was the chance he had been waiting for. He could not, he would not fail now. He must round up his men and lay his plans. He would, or the devil would know why, take Lincoln tomorrow night. Years ago tonight, the evening of April 13th, the night was cool and the skies were starry over Washington. But weather conditions and such day-to-day cares had no place in the minds of four men who met to plot against the leader of the Union. And as Booth had planned it, Lincoln would not be the only victim. There would be more, and he had, or thought he had, the men who could do the job.
My friends, the time is at hand when we, a group of freedom-loving men, can rise above our destiny and remove the tyrant from the face of this earth. We cannot, and moreover, we will not fail this time. Fate is on our side.
Tell us your plan.
In essence, Mr. Azarot, we are adhering to our original plan for the theater, and your job is not changed either. You will take a room at the Kirkwood House on Pennsylvania. Your room is below that of the Vice President's, Andrew Johnson. You will slay him.
Do you think I can do it, John?
You fool, of course you can. We brought you the weapons. You'll have the room. Find the desire and you cannot fail.
I shall do the very best I can.
Bane and Davy, you too will follow our original plan. You will take the life of our dear Secretary of State, and it shouldn't be too hard.
You're right there, John. He's in bed. And some say he might not even recover from the injuries he got when his carriage overturned.
Recover or not, my friend, let us say that you and Davy will, how shall I put it, speed up his lack of recovery? Now, let's go over it. George, tell us your duty.
Well, John, I'm staying at the Kirkwood. I'll wait until 10:15 or so tomorrow night, and then I'll just go up to the Vice President's room. I'll knock on the door, and when he answers it, I'll kill him. But I hope nothing goes wrong.
Nothing will go wrong, you idiot, if you stay away from the brandy and mind your business. I'll have no mistakes this time. Mind you, I warn you. Now, Davy, what do you and Lewis do?
Oh, that's easy, John. I'll just get a bottle of something from the drugstore, and I'll show Lewis the way over to the Seward place. When we get there, I'll just let Payne take the medicine inside. He'll tell the man at the door that he has a prescription, but he has to give it to Seward in person. And what a prescription, what a tonic he's gonna
Never mind that. Get on with it.
Well, there's nothing much more to say. Payne gets into the room with the bottle and kills the old man. Then I show him the way to the place where we'll meet.
Good enough, then. Payne, tonight you and Davy get the horses. Have mine taken around the back alley entrance to Ford's. Ned'll take care of it. We have nothing to lose, men, and everything to gain. I think it's only fitting that tomorrow, the 14th, is Good Friday. Because, my friends, we act in goodness, no matter what the tyrant's followers will say.
And so, the final plot was made. and the conspirators, a motley group, each in the deal for a different cause, went about their way. John Wilkes Booth, flushed now with visions of eventual success at last, walked to his room at the National Hotel. He approached the desk clerk.
A key to 228, please. Any mail for me, Dan?
None, Mr. Booth, but there's a call from a young lady. She's called several times now this evening.
Dan, there are times when such pleasures have to wait. I'm about business now, and it cannot wait.
A new play, sir?
Play such as you have never seen.
Booth mounted the steps to his room, feeling at last relaxed and thoughtful. This time, he would have his way. His name would ring down through the ages. The Colossus of Rhodes would fall. His place in history would be assured. History cannot say for certain whether thoughts such as these rang through the mind of John Wilkes as he headed for his room. But with Lincoln's life in the balance, it's amazing that Booth, at this crucial stage in his existence, could sit down and write a nonchalant letter to a member of his family, which is exactly what he did.
Dearest Mother, I know you expect a letter from me, but I am sure you will hardly forgive me. Indeed, I have had nothing to write about. Everything is dull. That is, has been until last night. Everything was bright and splendid. More so in my eyes if it had been a display in nobler causes. But so goes the world. Might makes right. I only drop you these lines to let you know that I am well and to say that I have not heard from you. I am your affectionate son, ever, John.
I am your affectionate son. And with that, Booth settled down for the last good night's rest he would ever have. When the evening hours blotted out the bright sunshine over the capital, Washington, the Lincoln family was like any other family in the city. Supper time arrived. Robert, home from the war at last, talked with his father and his mother, Mary. Tad gulped down his soup as if it were the last meal he would ever have.
Tad, my heart, believe me, you'll get a chance to eat again tomorrow. Do use your manners when you're eating at the table and try not to make so much noise when you eat.
Yes, son, it's not the end of the world. And I do believe you'll finish your meal without having your food forcibly taken from you. Try to eat a bit more conservatively.
Abe, the way that boy eats, you'd believe he'd just been told he'd have to starve for the next 6 weeks.
Mother, all young boys are the same. They seem to have the idea that during the next few moments in which they live, they may be called to duty for the sake of their country, or there is urgent business at hand which they must dispatch at once. Robert, tell me, what are you doing tonight?
Oh, nothing definite yet, Father. We may see a play, or go down to look at some of the victory celebrations. They're fantastic, you know.
Well, there's nothing wrong with seeing a victory celebration. Just be certain you don't find yourself hoping for another war as a good excuse for having another victory celebration in the future.
Oh, don't worry, Father. I've had enough of war. Oh, the uniform and the life suits me, but it's waged at too large a cost. I shouldn't want to go through it again for any price.
A quiet night in Washington, the eve of April 13th. The noise in the street diminished by the hour. Lamps were lighted, Bibles were read. The cat was dispatched into the street for its nighttime prowling. Nothing unusual about this evening in Washington City. It was just as relaxed and casual in the house on H Street, the boarding house run by the middle-aged widow, Mary Surratt. The three-story brick building with the number 541 in front was no different than most boarding houses in the city. The roomers slept in clean beds, changed twice a week. Mary, who had bought the boarding house to boost the widow's income, was known as a dependable woman. The trouble was that some of her guests were not so dependable. Oh, they were on the surface. For example, what burden of suspicion could you set upon the shoulders of John Wilkes Booth, the celebrated actor, the handsome fellow who visited the Surratt boarding house frequently these days, and the Reverend Lewis Payne, the tall, burly, handsome fellow who talked quietly with Booth at times in the ground floor bedroom, and John Surratt, the son of the widow, the youthful son, who quite possibly was a gadabout, but then wasn't everyone these days. Of course, Mary was disgusted at the sight of George Atzerodt, the bear-like sot who invaded her home at odd intervals. What on earth could a gentleman like Booth see in a drunken blob such as George was? Night fell, and the robins were quiet in the Washington Elms. They were tired after a full day of pecking, chatting, tweeting, and feeding. And the quiet descended on the Surratt boarding house as well.
Anne, daughter, get me my pills, won't you, please? They're in my bureau drawer. And just a taste of water, too, please.
Mother, I will. But what's the matter? You've been so jumpy lately. You're just not yourself these last few days. Maybe we should hire somebody in to do the scrubbing and all. You may be as pretty as usual, but, you know, the years do go by.
Oh, shush that kind of talk, Anne. And please get me my pills. I want to sleep well tonight. Tomorrow I may be more active than usual. Oh, and please stop by Lewis's room and see if he'd like some tea before bedtime.
Lewis was Lewis Weichmann, a quiet roomer in the Surratt house, but a roomer who had been keeping his eyes and ears open for many months now. Weichmann was attached to a government office. Weeks ago, he had reported to his superiors that there were strange goings-on inside the house on H Street in which he lived. His words of warning were put on paper, but that's as far as it went. For some reason, the Surratt boarding house was never checked into, nor were the occupants and visitors. And so the plot against Lincoln grew and grew, until tonight, April 13th, 100 years ago, the plot was beyond stopping. The plot revolved around a small expanse of space hung over the stage at Ford's Theater. That expanse of space was the presidential box. As you face the stage, it would be on your right, overlooking the stage itself. Normally, the presidential box was actually two boxes in one, boxes 7 and 8. But when the president and his lady visited the theater, a thin wooden partition separating the two boxes was removed, and the two boxes were transformed into one of good size, befitting the President of the United States. It was a good place from which to view the theater. You looked directly down upon the heads of the players. On this day, 100 years ago tonight, Ford's Theater was winding up its presentation of the play, Our American Cousin. The play would close tomorrow night, the night of Good Friday. And with President Lincoln living the last 48 hours of his life, the featured players rehearsed their lines. The heroine, Florence Trenchard, was played by Laura Keene, the toast of the circuit. The English actress was striving for a flawless reading, mindful that the president would be in attendance tomorrow night. Another character in the play was Mrs. Mount Chessington. Miss Helen Truman played the role of Augusta, and Harry Hawke was in the role of the comic Yankee Asa Trenchard. Tom Taylor, the English playwright, never imagined, when he wrote the burlesque comedy, that it would give the cue line for a great American tragedy.
No heir to the fortune, Mr. Trenchard?
Oh, no.
What? No fortune?
Nary a red. It all comes from their barking up the wrong tree about the old man's property.
Augusta, to your room.
Yes, Ma, the nasty beast.
I'm aware, Mr. Trenchard, that you are not used to the manners of good society.
Don't know the manners of good society, eh? Well, I guess I know enough to turn you inside out, you suck. Apologizing old man trap.
And those lines from Our American Cousin will be the cue for the firing of a pistol that will inflict a mortal wound upon the President of the United States, Abraham Lincoln. But the lines that would be spoken in the play, Our American Cousin, would not be heard for yet another 24 hours. Lincoln would hear those lines, and they would be the last words he would ever hear. But this is the night of April 13th, 100 years ago tonight. And although most of Washington City had retired, not all by any means. The night owls were out in the town. After all, the war was coming to an end. General Grant and his lady were in town. There were more celebrations to attend, and more whiskey and brandy to be gulped down in the hours preceding tomorrow's dawn. Among the celebrants were Booth's conspirators. George Atzerodt, the drink-heavy carriage maker from Port Tobacco, Virginia, was doing his duty to Booth as only he knew how. Following Booth's instructions, he took a room at the first-class hotel, the Kirkwood House. No sooner had he checked in than he retired to the surroundings he knew best. A bar, in this case, the Kirkwood Hotel Bar. With the task of assassinating Vice President Andrew Johnson hanging heavy upon his sagging shoulders, George looked for support at the bottom of a glass.
Bartender, I'll have another whiskey. And some information, if you please. Tell me, what room is the vice president staying in? I'm an old friend of the family, sir.
Whiskey it is. Could you tell me, sir, from what branch of the Andrew Johnson family do you spring?
None of your business, my friend. I'm just a friend of the family, that's all. If you please, sir, fill up my glass and lend me an ear for a moment more.
Another whiskey it is. And tell me, I haven't seen you in the hotel before. Just staying the night, are you?
Yeah, my friend, you might put it that way. Just staying the night. Tomorrow is Good Friday, and after all, I must observe the occasion. Incidentally, what kind of person is this Johnson, the vice president?
Oh, he's common enough. May tilt one himself, from what I've been told. But he's built like a bull and no fool for any man.
And, my good friend, that's just what I was afraid of, I fear.
Now, what do you mean by that, if I may ask?
Oh, nothing special. I was just thinking, that's all.
The conversation with the keeper of the bar at the Kirkwood Hotel marked the end of any determination George Atzerodt may have mustered up. His mind was not so muddled by the bottle that he was unable to tell when he was getting in over his head. He may have vowed then and there to forget his part in the plot, but his decision to leave the work to others came too late to save his life. The city of Washington was still deep in cheers. The joy of the war's end overcame all. Lurching good fellows tumbled in and out of the bars and made friends at a moment's notice. And why not? After all, it was a time for celebrating, and life was short enough as it was. Even as the gas lamps dimmed inside the Capitol homes, the fun seekers roamed through the metropolis, giddy and gay, carefree and fun-loving. And who could know what the hours ahead would hold? Only the conspirators. Some historians would say that some members of the government knew only too well what dangers lay ahead, but that is only supposition. As for Abraham Lincoln, he slept this night quietly away in the presidential bed. Mary Lincoln may have gone to sleep with only one small worry. Would the Grants be able to attend the theater with them tomorrow night? But the conspirators would fall into a restless sleep, their slumber pricked by the knowledge that on the morrow, Good Friday, there was work to be done. Not clean work, by any means. Tomorrow will be the last full day that Abraham Lincoln will have in this world of mortals. For the conspirators, tomorrow will be the last full day of living without pursuit. For Mary Lincoln, the wife, tomorrow will bring the beginning of a nightmare from which she will never recover.
Welcome, Mr. President. It's our pleasure to have you with us tonight. And more important, I hope you'll take a liking to our Laura Keene, who'll do her usual best tonight. Spurred on, of course, by the fact that you'll be in the audience.
Well, thank you. Although I have not seen our cousin before, Mother and I are looking forward to it.
Your box is ready, sir. Please let me show you to it.
Lead the way, my good man. Mother and I are at your disposal.
A brief glimpse at Lincoln's last day. A friendly party at the theater. The beginning of a day that would end in tragedy, not only for the president, but for the divided nation as well. The conspirators lay in wait. The stage is ready. The curtain will ascend, unveiling a deadly drama. The villain, John Wilkes Booth, has settled down for his last restful night's sleep. George Atzerodt is still drinking at the bar. David Harold and Lewis Payne are bedded down for the night. Tomorrow night, on the last days of Lincoln, we'll walk with the rail splitter. On his last day on earth. These are the last days of Lincoln.